Again, Psalm 19 and most pew Bibles, pages 541. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world. In the heavens, he has pitched a tent for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming forth from his pavilion, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The ordinances of the Lord are sure and altogether righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the comb. By them is your servant warned. In keeping them, there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then will I be blameless, innocent of great transgression. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. This is God's word.
Holy God, in this precious hour, we gather to contemplate the awesome gift of your creation. Open now our hearts and minds to see the truths that you have prepared for us this day. Free us from the fears that can overwhelm us, the prejudices or willful blindness that could cloud our judgment, and all the other worldly distractions that can so easily crowd out the message that you have for each one of us. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, what a privilege it is to be here at Park Street Church as the final one of the speakers brought in from the outside to celebrate 200 years of this amazing place that you all are part of. And I'm delighted to see so many people here on a rather gray afternoon. We'll try to make it as lively as possible in here. You're taking a real chance, though, to have a scientist come and speak as the final speaker. I have no credentials in theology. I'm not a pastor. I might really put my foot in something. I was tempted to bring PowerPoints, but I was advised against it. And I can tell you're pleased about that. Robert Jastrow, when he wrote a book about God and science, actually, his book was called God and the Astronomers. His first sentence in that book was, when a scientist writes about God, his colleagues assume he's either over the hill or going bonkers. I hope I am neither, but you can decide after a bit which of those fits. Hopefully neither one. I have written a book about this topic called The Language of God, and I will try to update that a bit with some of the comments I'd like to make for you this evening. And we have this plan, so there will be time for some questions afterwards. And I look forward to hearing the kinds of questions that you might want to pose about this interface between science and faith. I know there are scientists here this afternoon, and you know that scientists are believers in large numbers, although not the majority perhaps, but 40% of scientists in a recent poll say they believe in a personal God. We don't talk about that a lot in the halls of academia because there's no surer way to clear the seminar room than to bring up the topic of God. But in fact, by ourselves, occasionally in small corners, We who are scientists and who are also believers find that to be a marvelous way to put together worldviews, and find that when you are a scientist who's also a believer and you've had that wonderful moment of discovery, it is not only that you've learned something that no human ever knew before, but you've also glimpsed just a little bit of God's mind. And what an incredible rush that can be. My scientific worldview, you already heard a little bit about in the introduction. I'm a physician. I'm a geneticist. I had the great privilege of leading the Human Genome Project that read out the 3 billion letters of the human DNA instruction book and learned in the process how similar we all are to each other. Your DNA and mine are 99.6% the same, and that would be true regardless of which one of you I chose to do the comparison. And since the Genome Project finished its task in 2003, we have begun to apply that in truly dramatic ways to understand risks of disease and ultimately to come up with better means of prevention and treatment for diseases like cancer and diabetes and heart disease and mental illnesses and on down that long list of conditions that afflict far too many people and for which our medical care system is still imperfect. And so now, as the director of the National Institutes of Health, the largest supporter of biomedical research in the world, I have the responsibility, and it is both exhilarating and daunting, to oversee the ways in which we could now steer this ship forward to try to make those discoveries that are going to provide the benefits that we all hope and dream for. So that's how I spend my daytime and a lot of my nighttime, and sometimes early in the morning, in the middle of the night, because there's always something going on in biomedical research. But I am also somebody whose spiritual life is an important part of who I am. And you might wonder how that came to be. I think most would assume that scientists who are believers must be those who were trained in a religious tradition during childhood, found it to be an important part of their anchor in the storm, and stuck with it for the rest of their life, being blessed by that experience. And many scientists are of that sort. But that's not my story. I grew up in a home where faith wasn't practiced. It wasn't denigrated, but it wasn't considered relevant. My father is a college professor, my mother a writer. I was taught at home by my parents until the sixth grade, not because they were interested in instruction in religion, but because they thought the public schools were not up to their standards. And they might have been right. My mother turned out to be a phenomenally gifted teacher, and she gave me the gift of learning to love the experience of learning new things. And so when I got to college, after having limited exposure to any matters of faith, and we had those conversations in the dorm about who believes what and what's the evidence for this, and I kind of decided I didn't believe any of it. And it was kind of convenient not to as well. Those were the times where it was just fine not to imagine that there was anybody looking over your shoulder. So I became an agnostic, although I'm not sure I knew that word at the time. And then as I went to graduate school in physical chemistry, slipped more and more into atheism. And by the time I was well into my PhD in quantum mechanics, the only thing I found worth worshiping were second-order differential equations. But then I had a change of heart in terms of what kind of science I wanted to do. I got interested in biology. I decided if I was going to do biology, I wanted it to be relevant to human beings. I'd better go to medical school. And for reasons that still aren't clear to me, the admission committee decided that was good enough and let me enroll at the University of North Carolina, an experience I share with Daniel Hill. And there my thoughts about faith encountered some challenge, because until then this had all been rather hypothetical. And now I found myself sitting at the bedside of good North Carolina people who had terrible terminal diseases that our medical care system was not able to help with and who were facing the end. And I couldn't help but notice how those with a strong faith had this air of peace about them. And I knew that's not the air I would have if I was in their circumstance. I'd be terrified. And one afternoon, a particularly wonderful elderly grandmother who I was responsible for caring for and who had terrible heart disease and was nearing the end, shared her faith with me in a very simple, straightforward, very personal way, talking about how she was not afraid of death because she was going to meet her Savior. And I listened, a little embarrassed. It was so personal. And she finished, and then she looked at me and sort of quizzically, she said, "You know, doctor, I've just shared my faith with you, and you haven't said anything. What do you believe, doctor?" What a question. Nobody had ever asked me that question quite that way. And I suddenly felt this intense disquiet. My face flushed. I stammered something about, I'm not really sure. And I got out of that room as fast as I could. And then I wondered, what happened there? I'm an atheist. I should have just said, I don't believe any of it. But that didn't seem right. And I realized it wasn't just politeness that made it awkward. I really wasn't quite sure how strong my answer was. And then it gradually dawned on me what problem I had been avoiding for all of my 25 years. I fancied myself a scientist. Scientists are supposed to draw conclusions based on evidence. And I realized I'd never really thought about the question of God in those terms. Might there be some evidence? Well, maybe I'd better go see. I kind of figured there wouldn't be any, or that there would be evidence that would undergird my atheism, and then I wouldn't have any more embarrassing moments like the one I just had. But I'd better go see. So what to do? How do you find out whether there's evidence for God? Well, I didn't know. I picked up some of the original texts of the world's religions, including the King James Version of the Bible, and randomly went to a page in the Old Testament and thought, I'm in trouble here. I have no idea what these people are talking about. And the same with other religious texts. I could not figure them out. So I figured I got to have some help here. And there was a Methodist minister who lived down the street from me, and I figured, well, I'll just go knock on his door. Sam McMillan, this wonderful Methodist pastor who now runs a retreat center in North Carolina, recently got in touch with me, and we had a little conversation where he told me what that first meeting was like, and I've kind of suppressed it. He said, I knocked on the door, introduced myself, and said I was trying to find out why believers believed in God, because I really didn't understand that at all. And then he says, I added, just in case he was wondering, by the way, Pastor, if you think I'm coming to your church, I'd have to have a lobotomy first. I guess that was pretty clear. So he tried to answer some of my blasphemous questions. He invited me to go play golf with him. He tells me that every time he got ready to hit a golf shot, I would say something like, well, why does God allow suffering? He'd line up that 20-foot putt, and just as he's about to hit the ball, I'd say, you don't really believe in the virgin birth, do you? So he was quite tolerant. And ultimately, he said, you know, you're traveling down a path that others have traveled, and maybe you ought to read something written by another scholar who was an atheist and was trying to understand what belief was all about and wrote a little book about it. Maybe you'll recognize some of those same questions and see where this person went with them. And I didn't think that sounded too threatening. It was a pretty small book when he took it off the shelf, and I looked at the cover, and the cover didn't sound too threatening. The title was Mere Christianity. That didn't sound like he was making much of Christianity at all. And, of course, this was C.S. Lewis's amazing book, which if you have not read it, please find time to do so. This Oxford scholar who, like myself, had been an atheist and who set about to disprove anybody else's religion, unknown to him, uncovered all of the evidence that caused him to be a convert, not his plan. Well, that was a little scary, realizing where this was going, and I had to put this book down a lot of times before I finally got through it all. But it gradually, over the course of 2 long years, became more and more clear to me that the evidence was tilting in the direction of God and strongly away from the direction of atheism. G.K. Chesterton, another author I discovered later on, has this wonderful quote about atheism that had been my worldview. But Chesterton says, atheism is the most daring of all dogmas because it is the assertion of a universal negative. Scientists aren't supposed to assert universal negatives. That implies you know everything. Well, maybe atheists are implying they know everything. Think about it this way. Let me ask each one of you to think. If you had to draw a circle right now in the air that represents all the knowledge that has ever been in the entire universe or ever would be, well, you'd draw, you know, an enormous circle. And then if I ask you, okay, now draw on that same scale the circle that represents what you know right now. Even the most confident amongst us would kind of a little teeny sector there. Now suppose that the knowledge of God's existence happens to be outside your little circle. On the scale of things, that seems pretty plausible. So how then could any individual say, I know there is no God. There is no God. I am sure there is no God. You've just constricted all of the world's, all the universe's knowledge into your own little circle, which doesn't seem rational. So rationality then, I think, would say atheism just won't do. Agnosticism, okay, I could kind of get into that one, and that seemed comfortable for a while, but frankly, it seemed a little like a cop-out, like, okay, I don't really want to think about this anymore, so I'll be an agnostic. And I realized that wasn't going to do it. I'd started down this journey, I had to understand it better. So were there evidences for a creator God? Interestingly, some of those came back at me from the very science that I had been involved in and never quite thought about. The big question of all philosophy is, why is there something instead of nothing? I never thought about that question. It seemed kind of a silly question, but it's not silly at all. And there is no scientific answer to that, and nor will there ever be. And yet there is something. Why? Then there's, of course, mathematics that I had spent so much of my time on as a graduate student in physical chemistry. It didn't occur to me to ask the question, why does mathematics work to describe the universe? It really does work, you know. Eugene Wigner, the Nobel laureate in physics, called this the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. There's no particular reason why gravity should be an inverse square law, but it is. There's no reason why Maxwell's equations should work to describe electromagnetism, but they do. And in fact, theoreticians would tell you they know they're on the right track to a correct theory because the equations are simple, even beautiful. It does make you wonder if there's a mathematical mind behind all of this. And then you have the problem of the beginning, the Big Bang. How did the universe come to be? We know now that that was 13.7 billion years ago in an unimaginable flash, a singularity, and that science is unable to probe past that, going even further back. And that cries out for some explanation, since nature has generally not been observed to create itself. Where did this come from? And the only potential answer that I can see to that is there has to be a creator who is not part of nature, otherwise you've created nothing. In terms of a solution, you've ended up with an infinite regress. But if the creator is in fact outside of space and outside of time, time's important here, then the creator doesn't require an answer about beginnings because there is no beginning and no end for a creator outside of time. Now we're getting somewhere. Now we have the postulate of a creator who's a mathematician and a very good one and who's also out of space and time. And then there's this other amazing thing about how the universe is put together that makes you realize the creator must also be a physicist. Because those marvelous equations that describe how matter and energy behave have one other really interesting property that's only recently been appreciated. They have constants in them. Okay, gravity's an inverse square law, but there's a constant in there, the gravitational constant. You can't derive the value of that constant from theory. It just is what it is. It's a given. You measure it. Suppose it was a little different. Some days it feels like it's a little different on the heavier side, but it isn't. It's very constant there. Suppose the gravitational constant was just one part in a billion weaker than it is. One part in a billion. What would happen? Well, run the Big Bang forward with that slight change, and what happens? There's not quite enough gravity, then, to cause the coalescence of stars and planets and galaxies and us. It's just an infinitely receding set of particles, a sterile universe with no complexity, no real interest of any sort. Suppose the gravitational constant was just a tad stronger. Well, that doesn't work either. Yeah, then things come together, but a little too soon. And the Big Bang is followed by a big crunch long before we get to have this conversation today. So we live on this knife edge of improbability for the gravitational constant, and that's true for the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force and the speed of light and all these other things that you can't derive. They just are what they are, and they seem to have been chosen with this incredible precision to make complexity of any sort possible. Not just the kind of life we're used to, but any kind of life seems to demand complexity, doesn't it? And you don't get that unless you get all these constants in this terribly tight range. Well, you can't look at that and say, well, it's just a coincidence. You have some options, though. What are they? Well, it could be that someday some theoretician will figure out that actually the constants do have to have the value they do. But I don't know too many theoreticians who are too optimistic about that. There doesn't seem to be a reason why that would need to be the case. Second, maybe there is an infinite series, or close to that, of parallel universes that have different values of these constants. Those aren't very interesting. We are lucky because we're in the one where everything turned out right, and of course, we wouldn't be having this conversation if we didn't live in that one. So we won the lottery, and all those other universes lost out. Of course, we can't observe them. That's a hypothetical. That's a theory. Might require a little faith to believe in the multiverse, as it's called, but it is an option. And then there's the option that this was intentional. There's design here. That creator, who's a mathematician, was also a physicist, and was also interested in a universe that would generate something more interesting than a bunch of particles flying apart on into a cold eternity. Well, that's pretty interesting. It seems to me if you apply Occam's razor, the famous logical rule about if you have choices in front of you, you should pick the one that's the simplest. The God hypothesis looks pretty good here. Certainly, it seems to me, requires no less faith, or no more faith, rather, than believing in a multitude of unobservable universes with different constants and different physical laws. But, of course, that doesn't get you to the point of a God who cares about us. I've just gotten you to the point of the God that Einstein recognized. What about a personal God? Well, back to Lewis, that first chapter of Mere Christianity. It's called Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. What a grandiose title, I thought, when I first picked that up. What's he talking about anyway? Well, he's talking about the universal sense which distinguishes human beings amongst all other species of the knowledge of right and wrong. True of all cultures down through history. We put different actions based on culture in the column called right and the column called wrong, to be sure, but we don't disagree that there are such things as right and wrong, and we're called to do the right things. The moral law, it's sometimes called. The law of right behavior. Well, you might say, I'm not under that law. I did what I damn well pleased yesterday. And you probably might have done so, and all of us do that all the time. But isn't it interesting that when somebody does something that clearly deviated a bit from that law of right behavior, and you call them on it, they don't say, well, the hell with your law of right behavior. I don't care about it. No. They say, well, you don't understand. Actually, what I did was okay because, yeah, I was rude to that person, but he was really rude to me yesterday. And by our defense, we simply acknowledge that we're under that law after all, even when we break it. Well, what's that about? Certainly, evolutionary psychologists or sociobiologists who've been studying this will argue that some of this could well come about because of evolutionary pressure. Let's talk about altruism, sort of one of the more dramatic forms of this law of right behavior, where you go out of your way to help somebody else. Altruism, in its purest sense, you're not expected to get anything in return. Well, how would evolution benefit that? Remember, evolution cares about reproductive fitness and not a whole lot else. So how is your reproductive fitness assisted by being nice to somebody? If they happen to be your family member, there's a good argument here because they share some of your DNA. And so if you're helping them and they're surviving, your DNA is kind of indirectly surviving too. If it happens to be somebody you know, a friend, and you're helping them out in a tough time, well, they might help you the next time you need it. So your reproductive fitness might be advantaged by your generous behavior to those people who know you. Martin Novak here at Harvard has extended this to whole groups by doing computer modeling of things like the prisoner's dilemma and other versions of that particular model. And coming up with the sense that, yeah, you could see ways in which evolution would reward entire groups for altruistic behavior within the group. That's the critical part. If you're outside the group, however, all of these models require hostility, without exception. That's interesting. Because is that the way we, as humans, look at altruism? That you only have to be altruistic to people in your own group? No. You heard Layla talk about her visit to Haiti. You've seen the outpouring of efforts to try to help in a terrible tragedy. Most of the people who are doing that do not know the people they are helping, may not speak the same language, come from very different cultures. Evolution would say, they're really doing the wrong thing. This is a scandal. Stay home. be reproductively fit. Don't run off to this other country and help this other group that you're competing with for resources ultimately. And yet that's not how we feel. We have this deep sense within us that the real nobility of humanity requires us to act, especially in those circumstances where we don't even know the people who are hurting that we need to reach out to. Mother Teresa, Oscar Schindler, the Good Samaritan. That's a scandal, it seems, to an evolutionary argument. Now, the skeptics in the evolutionary community will say, well, you know, it's a misfiring of an altruistic, evolutionarily driven instinct that arose when everybody lived in small villages, and now we've somehow gotten mixed up and think the whole world is our small village. I'm not sure we should cede that argument so easily. And in fact, just one other thing about this that's worth considering. If you want to go there with the argument that evolution is entirely the explanation for the moral law, there's a consequence that will make you deeply uncomfortable. And that would say then that our ideas about good and evil are an illusion. They've been foisted upon us. We've been hoodwinked by a process that we haven't recognized was operating upon us. And there really is no such thing. And so the idea that we're called to try to do good, we may as well just shrug that off. If you're a strict evolutionist atheist, that might be where you have to go. And then you can't call religion evil anymore, which will be a problem for Richard Dawkins, but that's okay. Well, some of those arguments did very much affect me back there as I was walking through these phases of atheism to agnosticism to deism and now into theism. But they affected me also in a way that I hadn't been quite prepared for, which was actually rather disheartening. Because just as I began to see the evidence for a God and a personal God and the evidence for my own being under this moral law, I was also more and more apparent just how short I fell every day in my ability to live up to that. And if God was the author of that moral law, if this was a signpost to God, that meant God was good and holy and perfect, and I was clearly not. So how could I approach this God I was discovering in my imperfections? I figured I'd better go back to the world religions and find out how that got handled. And as I searched through them, now with somewhat of a better understanding of what I was looking for, I encountered this person of Jesus Christ. The world religions have many wonderful similarities. But this was a unique person who not only claimed to know God and to know about God, but to be God. And the historical evidence for this person, who I'd always thought was kind of a myth, was incredibly strong. One historian has written, the historicity of Jesus Christ is on the same level as the historicity of Julius Caesar. We know a lot about this person. And the more I read about this person, and the more I learned about the claims he had made, and N.T. Wright spoke here a few months ago, and in my mind, the most clear expositor of that evidence of what Christ said and what people thought of him, it seemed clear that he was demanding a decision. Because I had thought up until then that I could get away with saying that Christ was a good person, that the things that he said to his disciples and were recorded in the New Testament were wonderful teachings. But this part about being the Son of God, well, that was a little hard to take. Lewis, once again, caught me up on that one. And he says, in a fairly famous paragraph, I'm just going to read to you, I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. They say, I'm ready to accept him as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Lewis says, that is one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil himself. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something much worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon. Or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Wow. So after 2 years of this search, I found myself at the edge of a yawning gap, realizing that the evidence for God's existence was compelling but not proof, realizing the evidence for Christ as that bridge between my imperfections and God's perfection, which I had so long defined, was solving that problem for me, but still with some uncertainties. And for a few days, I lived in this sense of gathering distress about whether I could make this decision. And then, on a beautiful fall day, hiking in the Cascade Mountains in the Northwest, having gotten a couple of days off from an exhausting medical residency, where my mind was clear enough to be able to actually think, which is not easy to do when you're a resident in a busy hospital, it all sort of came together, and I realized my resistance was gone, and I was glad it was gone, and I was ready to yield. Not that I was certain of my decision, but it was the decision that I felt compelled to make. And on that afternoon, I gave in and became a follower of Jesus. That was 32 years ago. Now, I've had plenty of moments in those 32 years of wrestling with doubts. I think any believer who says they don't have doubts, you should ask them very carefully what they mean by that, because it seems like that's not the opposite of faith. It is, as Paul Tillich said, an element of faith to have doubts. But one of the things I've discovered is that doubts actually are a growing experience, because when a doubt hits you, there's usually something there you need to work on. And if you're willing to put that work in there and dig a little deeper, at least in my experience, it actually helps you broaden your understanding of faith. Well, you might say, now having heard this story, that I must be somebody who's capable of compartmentalizing my brain, because didn't you say, Dr. Collins, that you're a physician and a geneticist? And you're a believer? Doesn't your brain explode? How do you put that together? Well, what's the problem? Well, many people would say, evolution's the problem, you idiot. Don't you realize that evolution is absolutely incompatible with the first book of the Bible, and that anybody who's accepted evolution as a true theory has automatically ruled out God? That is the view you will hear in many quarters. I've never understood that view, and let me explain why. First of all, let me say that the evidence for descent from a common ancestor by the process of gradual change with natural selection operating on the system is an absolutely incontrovertibly proven theory. This is as much a true statement as gravity, that evolution does explain the relatedness of living things, and that's partly from the fossil record, but for me who studies DNA, it's particularly now from DNA, the digital record of how we're all related to other species, right down to the most intimate details, which could otherwise only be explained if you consider that God was a deceiver and hid clues in our genome that would make us look like we were descended from a common ancestor just to test our faith. That is not a comfortable scenario. If God is the author of truth, I don't think that works. So let us say with great concern that many in the church, particularly in the evangelical Christian church, have adopted a view, therefore, that evolution is the enemy, that evolution means atheism, and frankly, the atheist colleagues in the scientific communities have contributed to that by using evolution as a club over the head of believers, making them even more convinced they have to resist this in order to defend their faith. And we've gotten into a terrible muddle about this. But couldn't God have used this elegant means of creation? Why not? Who are we to say I wouldn't have done it that way? Here's a synthesis that I find and have found now for more than 30 years, entirely compatible with everything I know as a believer and as I know as a scientist. Almighty God, who is not limited in space or time, began this universe 13.7 billion years ago with its parameters precisely tuned in order for complexity to be possible. That plan included evolution as the mechanism by which marvelous, diverse organisms would come to populate this small blue planet. And that also included the certainty that that evolutionary process would ultimately result in a big-brained creature, sufficiently big-brained to be able to accommodate concepts such as consciousness and free will and the moral law. And having received those gifts through the evolutionary process, that species did appear, and that's us. We, in turn, used the free will that we had acquired through God's grace to disobey God, and were therefore estranged from our own Creator. And Jesus Christ is the solution to that estrangement. Now, that's a rather simple way of assembling a lot of information, but I find it enormously satisfying to put it into those terms. You may raise objections, and the Q&A will probably hear some. Certainly, Genesis, if read literally, would not be compatible with that 13.7 billion years. But the literal reading of Genesis, which is now considered the only acceptable one in many evangelical churches, is a fairly recent arrival on the scene. Augustine, writing in 400 AD, who was obsessed with Genesis, he wrote four books about it, ultimately concluded that it was not possible to determine exactly what the meaning of those verses were, and wrote this particular pair of sentences specifically about this, warning us about not choosing a narrow view when there is ambiguity in scriptural verses. Here's what he wrote. In matters that are so obscure and far beyond our vision, we find in Holy Scripture passages which can be interpreted in very different ways without prejudice to the faith we have received. In such cases, we should not rush in headlong and so firmly take our stand on one side that if further progress in the search for truth justly undermines this position, we too fall with it. What an exhortation for today, coming down the centuries from Augustine. Would that we would think more carefully about that in some instances where we stake our entire faith on a particular interpretation of a verse where ambiguity is clearly a possibility. This is hermeneutics. We aren't very good at it anymore, I'm afraid. So you could call this synthesis life by God speaking it into being, bios through logos. And that is the origin of biologos that was mentioned by Pastor Harrell. And I would encourage you, if you want to look at more information about this synthesis, you can go to www.biologos.org, B-I-O-L-O-G-O-S, and you'll see a whole lot of information there as well as frequently asked questions that people pose. You should also get Daniel Harrell's book called Nature's Witness because he will walk you through a lot of these issues. And if you're a scientist and interested in how to put science and faith together, the American Scientific Affiliation, which has its headquarters only a few miles from here, is an organization of thousands of scientists who are believers. And you'd be welcome to get their journal and consider going to some of their meetings. And there are flyers about ASA out on the table outside. So to conclude, I have learned through this long process that God essentially gave us two books. Yes, He gave us the book of God's words, the Bible, which I venerate. And He also gave us the book of God's works, nature. And I cannot see how those books could conflict. If you think that there are areas that could cause trouble there, we can talk about that. But let me just finish by asking you then that same question that that lovely woman asked me that afternoon when I was 25. Wherever you are now, whatever your worldview is, whether it's well-developed or a little uncertain, it would be good to think about that question. What do you believe? And then why do you answer it in the way that you do? And are you sure you have considered the evidence? For this, after all, everybody, must be the most important question that we humans ever ask ourselves. Is there a God? If that's not a question that you have really wrestled with enough to be sure you've looked at the evidence, this would be a great time to start. After all, when the disciples asked Jesus, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." Jesus wants our minds and our hearts and our souls. What do you believe? Let us pray. Holy God, we thank you for the gift of these two books. We read them. We seek knowledge. More than that, we seek wisdom. In your word, you have promised that if anyone seeks wisdom, it will be given to them freely and without reproach. We seek that tonight. Grant us now the wisdom we so desperately need to answer that question about belief. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you so much. Well, we got time for a few questions. Phone number up here. Ben, if you throw that up, we can give you a chance. If you want to text a question in, do that, or raise your hand. Perhaps I would start with one. Speaking of God, the biologist, and evolution, one of the things that often is a big stickler for folks is just the enormous amount of death and dysfunction that evolution seems to require. It does seem to be out of sorts with how we would imagine God and His love and goodness to be. I wonder if you could speak to that for a second.
Yeah, I think that is one of the big questions that everybody faces. And regardless of your spiritual worldview, the evidence is certainly compelling. From the fossil record, from all of that we know about the history of our own planet, that species have been arriving and departing. The dinosaurs being wiped out by that asteroid 63 million years ago is just one example. There are various answers to that. I must say, I don't think this is an easily resolved question. One might argue that in God's scheme of things, it is us creatures in God's image who are most of concern, and therefore that it might be possible, because of the need for this outcome, and because of there not being another available way to accomplish it, that evolution was the choice. You know, you can't sort of put together an irrational statement and say God can in front of it and make it rational. So some of the other means of creation, the snapping of the fingers, might basically result in an irregular universe without any laws that you could depend on, which would in turn ruin the ability for us to have this conversation or to seek after God. I think also you have to remember that God's perspective is much more than what we see. We look through a glass darkly. We consider, therefore, death and suffering as a terrible thing in every instance and as the end of life. But, of course, in God's perspective, there may be much more going on just through that curtain.
My phone's buzzing off the hook here. Hang on.
All right.
Well, obviously, it's off the hook. Given, in as much as humans come into being via evolution, how does the existence of our souls fit into humans being created completely by evolution?
Okay. Are we going to do monism or dualism here?
That's the question.
I thought it was. My lack of philosophical and theological credentials is about to become patently clear. What is the soul anyway? I think the concept of the soul as part of our spiritual nature and perhaps separable from our physical body, so that's where the monism-dualism argument kicks in, is a pretty critical one for all religious perspectives. I don't think we're going to catch the soul by the scientific method. Almost by definition, if this is the spiritual part of us, then science is the wrong set of tools to explore it. So I'm not sure the study of biology or evolution or even neuroscience is likely to help us with this ongoing discussion about what the soul really is.
How do you balance the time required for your professional scientific career and your spiritual life?
With challenging difficulty, because my current professional life is a 100-hour-a-week job trying to manage this enormous complex organization called the National Institutes of Health. And I would not say that I'm as dedicated and disciplined about my spiritual life as I would claim to want to be. I'm up at 4:30 in the morning. I'm trying most mornings to try to start it off on the right foot by reading a few verses. I will confess there are times where my mind is somewhere else and I have to pull myself back into that. And then I have those glorious moments where God really seems to be speaking to me. And many times those happen because I'm in fellowship with other people. But I'm still on this path, too. I'm still trying to learn how to be a believer in the right way.
Human cloning.
Let's not do it.
Okay. Other than evolution, what other major scientific discovery is thought to disprove God that you would disagree with?
I can disprove God. Well, I mean, evolution has always been sort of the big one.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I suppose in some people's view, even the discovery that the Earth was not the center of the universe was thought to disprove God. I mean, run the clock back a little bit to Galileo's observations, and that was very upsetting to people who said, no, wait a minute, the Psalm said the Earth is fixed and shall not be moved, and so you must be wrong, and our faith is at risk. We must suppress this. So it depends on the time you live in, I guess. Right now, it's evolution. It's been other things.
Life on other planets?
I look forward to finding out if there's life on other planets. One of my good friends, who's also a wonderful believer, who is now the head of the Hubble Space Telescope, actually is somebody who's responsible for trying to find life on other planets, exobiology, as it's called. And she and I have talked about this. Jennifer Wiseman is her name, and she has the view that if God was capable of keeping track of 6 or 7 billion of us, would it really be that hard to throw in another few billion planets? I mean, come on here. God is great. We sang that song. God is great. Now, it would raise some interesting questions about, does that mean there has to be a resurrection on all those planets? That would be interesting to talk about without probably being able to answer the question for some time.
You guys are killing me here. I've got like 78 messages. But let's go to stem cell research.
Okay.
What about stem cell
research?
What
about it? Well, there's lots of different kinds of stem cell research, which is one of the reasons it gets everybody worked up, because they get all mixed together. I think the kind that has caused the most controversy is human embryonic stem cell research. That is where embryos, which are created as part of in vitro fertilization, trying to give couples who are infertile the chance to have a child, end up in greater numbers than they can be reimplanted as part of the in vitro fertilization process, and so they are frozen away or sometimes just discarded. There are 400,000 of those embryos now in freezers. Some would argue that to use those for any research purpose is immoral because of the sanctity of the embryo, and I do feel quite strongly that the fusion of sperm and egg is the beginning of a human being and deserves a high moral status. But if there are 400,000 of these embryos already created for benevolent reasons, and they are almost all of them going to be thrown away, is it more ethical to take a few of them and try to do something with them that might help somebody with Parkinson's disease or diabetes or spinal cord injury? I think reasonable people can debate about that, but I think you can make a strong ethical case as a believer who really has confidence in the value of human life that there's a case here to be made for that research to go forward. And it is unfortunate that so many of those discussions quickly deteriorate into positions where people have already kind of locked themselves down on a particular view. The most exciting kind of stem cell research, though, for treatment right now is not those kinds of stem cells, but something called induced pluripotent stem cells, where we've learned how to take one cell from your skin, put 4 new genes into it that it didn't normally express, and have it become effectively the same kind of cell as an embryo, an induced pluripotent cell. And then you could take that cell and cause it to become a neuron or a liver cell, or whatever it is you happen to need, without going through the risk of rejection, because these are your cells. Now, this ultimately may be the most exciting development in medical therapeutics in a long time, or it may turn out that there are problems we haven't anticipated yet with safety, but it is enormously exciting right now to be involved in that area of science.
A question here about the role of prayer in biological processes. And as much as... You get a lot of that.
You never know.
The role of prayer in changing biological processes.
Interesting question, and a very hard one to try to figure out what's really happening, because I think if prayer is influencing outcomes, it's not clear to me that God would set it up in such a way that we would know. And experiments have been done with people in hospitals with particularly bad diseases where people were praying for them without them knowing it, and others who sadly were not being prayed for, and then the question was, who was more likely to get better? And the largest experiment that was done with that showed no difference. Now, imagine just what a strange experiment this is. Is it your idea that prayer is done by somebody for somebody who doesn't know they're being praying as part of a scientific experiment? Does that seem like the real legitimate kind of use of prayer? It's kind of contrived, isn't it? So I wouldn't say that that necessarily answers the question. I would say that one of the things that's more and more clear to me is that prayer is not necessarily a way of trying to get the answer you want or manipulating God to do what you want God to. For me, prayer is usually trying to get in fellowship with God, trying to get a sense of some kind of message that I'm missing to help me to grasp the situation, not to sort of tell God, hey God, you didn't notice, I need you to do this, are you paying attention? And that was my prayer life early on, and now I think it's probably become clear that's not necessarily what prayer is all about. Mm-hmm.
So many of the questions you guys are asking are addressed on the BioLogos site, so biologos.org.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just end with one last one, though. Why is God so taboo in some scientific circles?
Well, it wasn't always so. If you look back over the past few centuries, many scientists were very strong Christian believers. Isaac Newton wrote more about interpretation of the Bible than he did about physics and mathematics. It's more recently, since we seem to have arrived at this point where there's been a strong separation between scientific and spiritual perspectives. Some of that on a totally legitimate basis. We live in a country where church and state are supposed to be separate, and so in state institutions you have to be clear about that. And furthermore, I think we're all very sensitive to not wanting to seem to impose our religious views on other people. We're into pluralism, and that's a good thing, and I even worry by talking so personally about my own Christian faith that I have made some people feel like I'm trying to impose that upon you. I am not. Everyone has to make their own search for what is true. This just happens to be the search that I've been on. So I think in academia, we're being polite, and frankly, a lot of scientists just are made very uncomfortable by these discussions because it's threatening to imagine that the way in which you've kind of been living your life, which is to use the scientific method to get answers, might not actually be the way to get answers to every question. And that is a hard threshold to get past. Questions like, is there a God? And does God care about me? And is there life after death? Those are not questions that scientists generally at work are going to be talking about, and yet those are the ones where the spiritual worldview would be necessary. If it's a question about, okay, was that a C or a T in that stretch of DNA, that's not a question where your religious faith should probably enter the question, and therefore it's appropriate that we keep these conversations separate. But I'm sorry, in fact, to see that we've arrived at such a strong dividing line so that even sometimes on social occasions it becomes difficult for people to raise this issue. I'm delighted to see all of you here because you apparently have some interest in this issue, or else somebody told you to come and you're sorry you came in and it was too embarrassing to leave. But I must say, I speak on college campuses, or I did before I became a federal employee and they wouldn't let me. And it was amazing to see the outpouring of student interest in this question about science.